our scheduled programming. Hello, Happy New Year, and welcome to the first Big Mouth of 2017, where, as usual, we'll be talking about what's worth paying attention to in music, film, books and TV. My name's Andrew Harrison, I write for the New Statesman, Esquire and Guardian, and joining me to let the new year in are two special guests. He is the Guardian's music editor, and therefore he exercises a Nero-like power over band's careers. He's an indefatigable QPR fan, and he's anybody's for some quality 70s soft rock. It's Michael Han. Hello, Michael Han, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, and Happy New Year to everyone.
How was your Christmas?
Hey, well, it was rather overshadowed by the death of George Michael,
because
I couldn't just be sad. I had to come into the office at 11:30 on Christmas night and then work till 4:30 in the morning and then be back in the office at 9:00 the next morning dealing with George Michael.
Yeah, it's. I mean, do you? How do those phone calls go? Do you literally end up ringing somebody in the middle of the Queen's speech, or they've got, you know, did you?
Not at that time of night. I ring around people to see who was sober enough to write things. I won't name the writer. The senior Guardian music writer.
Oh, really?
Who said,
I'm
asleep. Can it wait till the morning? George Michael's died. But it's going to have to wait till the morning, isn't it?
Can't you treat it like when the Queen dies, they sort of pretend that she died 8 hours later, peacefully at home in Buckingham Palace, and not, you know...
Was waiting for that. When it was all, like, heavy cold, I was like, oh, yeah.
She's going to outlive a lot of us.
Oh, there were conspiracy theories floating around, weren't there, about the Queen? So they were just putting it off to the New Year so as not to ruin people's Christmas. Yeah. But, yeah, she's long dead. She's in the ground, frankly.
This is the voice of the Liberal Guardian there, talking Britain down as usual. Also with us, he is the author of Future Days, Krautrock and the Building of Modern Germany. He was Melody Maker's Mr. Agreeable and Mr. Abusing, and he's a long-suffering Arsenal fan. He writes for The Wire, and when Saturday comes, it's David Stubbs. Hello, David Stubbs.
Hello there.
Welcome back to
Big Mouth.
Happy
New Year indeed to everybody.
Happy New Year to everybody. This is going to sound great. You've
set the precedent, I obviously have to, you know, follow up, otherwise I look a bit churlish, don't I?
How was your Christmas break period, David?
No, it was very fine, actually. Oddly enough, I got a lot of work done, actually. I mean, Christmas Day itself can actually be, it's surprising the kind of long years you get on a Christmas day.
What did you do on Christmas Day?
I just work on the book. I do about 3,000 words.
Right.
Between the mince pies and what have you.
I talked to a mate, a Jewish friend, and he was saying that his dad always used to do a bit of work on Christmas Day because he felt bad about getting the Jewish holidays off. And also the Christian ones. He felt like he ought to do a little bit and would disappear into the study. Did you get anything nice?
No, you get presents anymore, actually. Yeah. I think it's weird. You get to a certain stage and you don't really mind, you know. I mean, when I was, you know, I remember like in 1972, you know, when you had proper Christmases.
Yes.
And I mean, you know, I got a Monopoly set.
Brexit Christmases.
And it was just... Absolutely, yeah. Exactly. No, but it was I got a Monopoly set, and it was an absolute joy, and that was like the next 9 months sorted.
Well, I think it's partly, listeners may not sympathise with this, but those of us in this room who have basically spent our entire working lives getting free stuff.
Yes, CDs, absolutely.
CDs, records,
yeah.
books, film tickets. Yeah. It's very hard to buy for us, but also it's very hard for you to buy presents. I mean, when I was a teenager, I used to take great delight in buying my dad a CD or an album for Christmas or a tape. Yeah. But if you do it now, he goes, oh, that's nice. You got it off the pile, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much. Who did you ring up together? And books as well. Well, you can't get anything. Yeah. So everybody gets a bottle of whiskey and then gives it back to you again next year. Also with us, ensuring that we sound crystal clear and coherent, it's the Connie Plank of podcasts. It's our producer, Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you?
I'm very well, Andrew.
And Happy New Year to you.
And to you too.
How was your Christmas break?
It was really good. I got a really good present. I got a book from my wife, which is massive.
Yes.
And it's got, on the front, it's got every cartoon The New Yorker ever published.
Ever?
And I was going, that's got to be... But then you open it up, and although it's a massive book with lots of cartoons in it, it's also got two DVDs mounted in the front cover with every cartoon.
Because otherwise, this would have been 18,000. It would be
you'll notice it didn't say every funny cartoon The New Yorker had ever published, because that'd be like a paperback of about 50 pages in it.
Ah, come on.
But yes, no, that was good.
And you were just telling us before we started recording, you had an exciting Christmas experience in a supermarket.
I did. I saw Jenny Agutter.
Oh, yes.
In the supermarket.
What was she buying?
I don't know. She was actually coming out. And I also need to report. Because of the old kind of line, she was fully clothed.
You know, it's
acting. I saw no underwear.
It's acting when they take their clothes off. You know, they don't go to the supermarket.
But there was a rumour, wasn't there, that she every film she was in, you actually saw her knickers, even The Railway Children.
Even The Railway Children.
Because she ran down the hill waving them to stop the train.
Right, moving swiftly on before you get us into any further trouble. Okay, we're going to start with telly. We're going to start with the addictive Netflix show of the Christmas period, variously described as the new Donnie Darko, a David Cronenberg version of the unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, and the mumblecore Stranger Things. The OA launched on Netflix in mid-December. It tells the story of a young middle American woman who disappears without trace and then reappears 7 years later, having changed in possibly supernatural ways. It's a deeply strange series. You're never quite sure where you are as a viewer or what you're watching. Before we talk about it, here's something from the soundtrack that captures the flavour of the OA. This is Beach House and All Your Years.
hush, don't you cry.
House and All Your Years from the soundtrack to The OA, the new eight-part series currently on Netflix. Now, Michael Hann, you've seen the whole thing without too many spoilers. What did you make of it overall?
It's a stirring hymn to the power of interpretative dance.
Oh, yeah? I haven't come to that part yet.
Oh, I really couldn't make up my mind about it.
Yeah.
I couldn't decide whether it was daring and thrilling and different or whether it was just a piece of unbearable hokum, and I think it may in part be both. My biggest problem with it was the utter humorlessness of it. And what I liked about Stranger Things was the knowingness, the fact that they're saying this is entertainment, you know, we don't mind the ridiculousness. With this, with the OA, the central premise is so staggeringly ridiculous, yes, it's treated with utter seriousness.
Well, let's give the listeners who haven't seen, let's give them the central premise. It's like we're kind of in middle American nowhere land. A woman has disappeared and she's returned with scars that can't be explained, and I don't think this is much of a spoiler because we discover in the first 5 minutes. Previously, she was blind and now she can see, just like Bobby Gillespie in Moving Out. and she's been chatting, and it takes an awful long time before we find out even an inkling of what's supposed to be going on.
Well, I don't think it spoils it too much because you're not talking about the actual plot mechanics to say that the centre of the show is a search for a portal to another dimension through interpretative dance. I mean, that is what it is about.
Yeah, she's going to take your brain to another dimension.
And
pay close attention.
It's, of course, you have to suspend disbelief watching any fiction. You have to especially suspend disbelief watching sci-fi. But this is just so far beyond the norm, and yet presented as, no, but actually it's just a mainstream entertainment TV show. You go, no. I can believe in Stranger Things that there is the Upside Down haunted by monsters. That seems perfectly natural. But entering other dimensions through interpretative dance, I'm not having it. Like Noel Gallagher, I am not having it.
Excuse me, Michael Hann, you would be perfectly happy to accept it from The Man Who Fell to Earth, where we see interpretative dance used for all kinds of things, such as reproduction and communication.
Well,
and
that depends
else.
On...
It's just because it's David Bowie.
That depends on your assumption that I think The Man Who Fell to Earth is not unbearable hokum, but it is unbearable hokum.
Do we have a red card in the studio? David Stubbs, what did you make of the OA? Did you enjoy it?
Well, I didn't see... I've only seen the first couple of episodes.
Yeah. So Mike has just ruined it.
I must admit, he's tilted me in a specific direction from that. And it is towards the exit, I have to say. It's an invidious task with these kind of things anyway, because, you know, the whole kind of spoilers business. I mean, you know, and it's very, very hard. People say, what can you say? I can't say anything. Well, what is it? It's anybody. You just have to watch it. You know, there's always the problem with these series. It's like, you know, with things like Breaking Bad, you know, 7 years later, there's still people who can't discuss about Breaking Bad. Well, because it's in a part of the DVD waiting, you know. Oh, Christ, you know. I mean, that's something I'm just going to come on to. But in terms of the actual thing itself, yeah, I mean, it was kind of intriguing, the kind of premise or whatever, but there's all kinds of sort of, you know, just the idea of somebody, you know, being adapted to sort of being able to see after swimming a life blind in itself, you know, it's not something that just airily happens or whatever. There's all kinds of sort of, you know, people in real life, you know, people just don't adapt, you know, like that as quickly. So clearly, you know, the whole sort of supernatural aspect, you know, I do find hard to swallow, especially when, you know, as Michael said, it's presented with such sort of deadly earnestness.
But that could have been quite interesting. I was like, in the first episode, she's found after 7 years in a city that near where she lives, some way away from where her family lives.
St. Louis,
yeah.
I thought.
Okay. And when they bring her home, there's a massive crowd outside in the street. The feeling is that people are shouting out, God did this. And there's some kind of religious hysteria. There's a lot of people. And that, I thought, was quite an interesting angle, which then 2 hours later they walk out of the house and everyone is gone. And obviously there are budgetary constraints, but I don't think there are that many budgetary constraints.
Multiple angles. Yeah. I mean, clearly, you know, that's a sort of intentional effect. And it is very, you know, there is really disorientation. When I had a sort of sneak peek later on at, like, various things that transpire, I thought, how on earth does he get from there to there? you know, it's definitely intriguing enough. I do really like the soundtrack, actually. I think things are really well soundtrack these days. There's so much great left field music sloshing around in that sort of, you know, that sort of.
To me, it's more of a mood thing than a spoilers are kind of irrelevant, really. It's not really about plot. It is a gigantic, strange odyssey through the American subconscious. I think you can work that out pretty quickly.
I think one of the problems with it as a mood piece, though, is the absolute failure to develop character. Only Britt Marling as the OA and Jason Isaacs as Hap I suppose her parents are allowed to have characters. And she's surrounded by this array of stereotypes, fundamentally. Yeah. There's the academically ambitious Asian-American kid. All we learn about him is that he's destined for brilliance. That's it. Then there's no further reference to his academic career. There's the girl who wants to transition to being a boy. Mm-hmm. We learn that in passing. Again, no more reference to her. There's the horrible bully with the troubled background. But again, the troubled background isn't really delved into. So you don't learn enough about these people's motivations. And those five characters, the five characters who surround the OA are absolutely essential to the mechanics of the plot. Yeah. But we're not really allowed to understand why they get themselves drawn into the OA's orbit.
I definitely felt that sense of frigidity. I definitely had also that feeling that I was watching almost like some sort of extended music video in which it was just like sort of cryptic, almost for the sake of it at times.
Yeah.
And just, it's been that what you're talking about, all those characters that they're kind of loading up for this incredibly long haul. I mean, you know, it seems these days, you know, you don't find out what happens in a series for 7 years, you know.
Yeah.
I'd really like to get back one time to finding out what happens after 90 minutes.
Well, that was the thing that really rang alarm bells and made my heart sink yesterday evening when I was watching it. Watching the first one, which is not feature length, but is longer than your average episode. 50 minutes in, the opening credits starts.
Yeah.
that was brilliant.
Yeah, I like that. That was amazing.
And I was like,
that
oh,
I do like.
Jeez.
There were elements that were a bit like, you know, Horace and Pete, you know, the Louis C.K. thing, which is great, you know, that like the episodes might be half an hour long or they might be kind of, you know, much further length.
I thought it really reminded me in tone and in colour and in mood of Hal Hartley, who made a lot of films, but the films that he first made when he first came out, like Trust and The Unbelievable Truth, kind of that washed out winter Midwest, not very good haircuts.
And also people saying absolutely absurd things with a completely straight face.
But the problem was that Hal Hartley actually did make you care about the characters because they were kind of little pieces around kind of two or three people that were self-contained and quite kind of sweet, whereas this is
That first episode, the opening credits after 50 minutes, I think that's actually the best thing in the series. But not just because of the kind of funniness of it, but there's a mood shift there that doesn't occur anywhere else in the whole series, where you've spent 50 minutes in wintry Michigan, all dun colours and muted tones, and suddenly, it's like the Wizard of Oz, it explodes into colour in Russia.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the bright white of the snow, the bright colours of the little girl's dress, and suddenly it's, whoa! Oh, this could be amazing. But then it retreats from that very quickly.
Yeah. What do you think? I mean, this is possibly the daftest question of the lot. What are they trying to say with this? What is Britt Marling and... what's his name? The co-creator.
His name you can't pronounce.
Yes, I can. Zed Batmanjali.
Well done.
There you go. I just couldn't find it on my notes. I can pronounce it. What are they trying to say here? Is it an American beauty style odyssey through the American mind, or is it just a bunch of stuff that happens?
Well, apparently they made a film of similar tone together a few years ago, which I've not seen, which was shown at Sundance. I think fundamentally they're trying to say, look how clever we are.
Yeah.
I think Britt Marling in it is brilliant. I mean, she's really
young, as well, 33.
Oh, that's a measure of our age, isn't it? Oh, she's very young.
Very young. Yeah,
absolutely.
I've got a good nerd spot out of this.
I think that is pretty young.
Got a quality nerd spot out of this. Alice Krieg, who plays our mum, is the Borg Queen from the Star Trek movie.
I remembered that as well.
Yes, absolutely. Bringing it back into terms that I can understand.
Another thing, though, is they refer a couple of times to Strange on the Train. And I presume that's a reference to the Hitchcock thing.
Yeah.
It gets me, that sort of cultural reference, I'm sure, it's like, you know, how The Simpsons was loaded with cultural references and things like that all the time. And you know, everybody would probably get them because everybody at that age, you know, you would see these things on telly all the time on mainstream TV. You would just collide inevitably with Hitchcock films, you know, The Twilight Zone. I don't think that's been the case for the last 15, 20 years. I just wonder, you know, there'll be a lot of things. What the hell's Strange on the Train?
Especially,
would you see it now?
Especially a jock bully who goes around punching people in the throat for singing.
Yeah, that's
well,
right.
You know?
Yeah, I
know.
Yeah, exactly.
That I didn't buy. So have we reached peak Netflix then? Ever willing to watch essentially 8 hours of kind of meandering tones and feelings rather than...
I'm not willing. Yeah, I'm bailing.
Okay, well, basically it's January and there's nothing else on, so you'll probably watch it. That was the OA. Let's move on and we'll have some music. Each week we ask our guests to come in with an editor's recommendation, a tune that's been occupying their mind for the past few weeks. David Stubbs, I believe you've got some really, really ancient hip-hop for us.
Yeah, I don't know. I've just been... There's reasons and some work I'm doing. I've just been sort of listening to hip-hop from about 30 years ago because I was just starting out in a music journalist, and hip-hop... And what's... Obviously, at that point, you know, the idea that hip-hop was going to go global, I mean, you know, it would just, is this a passing fad? You know, yeah. Really, the idea is
this just
a
sort
of... Yeah, that's yes. Right. Is this kind of most recent mutation? But obviously, hip-hop was just such a very different proposition back then. And there's some astonishingly kind of raw... You know, there's some astonishingly raw stuff, some raw material. Also, I think the emphasis is different, obviously, in the 70s, late 80s in hip-hop, where... People are discussing their skills more.
Yeah.
You know, and you get, you know, people are coming in troops, and you quite often you've got like a little collective, you know, like, you know, people like Electromagnetic Industries. Quite often what's under discussion, the bragging, it's just all about their skills. And then later on, they shift away from that, where they just enter into sort of, I don't know, gangster fantasy or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's just, I suppose it just strikes me the difference between where hip hop was then and just how it went global. I remember interviewing Chuck D. This is probably about 1989, 1990. He was just talking about hip-hop's everywhere, man. You know, you've got Atlanta hip-hop. And me thinking at the time, man, this is just one of your many delusions. Hip-hop is just a local, there's a New York, we said West Coast thing. He was absolutely right. You know, all kinds of stuff was going on. And not just that, but, you know, it's an absolutely global. Yeah.
Well, let's have a listen to some of the prehistoric hip-hop from David Stubbs' collection. This is Rip the Cut by the Skinny Boys. It's a period to other. Super J! What's up? Rip the cut! Rip the cut! Yo, go out there, go crazy! Go crazy! The deaf sounds of dope DJ Stubbsy Stubbs there. That was the Skinny Boys with Rip the Cut from hip-hop's prehistory. Okay, so let's get back to 2017 with a record that sounds like 1972. January is always a terrible dead time for album releases, but when I mentioned coming on the show to Michael Hann, he said we have to do this record. It's a collaboration between the British singer-songwriter Flo Morrissey and the hirsute Southern Soul producer Matthew E. White. It's a covers album, although you really wouldn't know it. From the album Gentlewoman Ruby Man, here is, believe it or not... The theme from Greece. I solve my problems and I see the light. We got a loving thing, we got to feed it right. There ain't no danger, we can go too far. We stop believing now that we can be what we are. Greece is the world. How nice to hear Morrissey not going on about the royal family or Burger King there. Possibly the least January record imaginable. That was Flo Morrissey and Matthew E. White with the theme from Greece. Note the I Can't Stand the Rain arpeggio there. We all high-fived ourselves.
We all spotted it.
Spotting that one. Yeah. Okay, so David Stubbs, what did you make of this record?
Yeah, I thought it was tremendous. And I came to it absolutely stone cold. You know, yeah. I didn't know press release. I just, you know, just sort of dived in. And after about sort of the initial sort of thing, is this a little bit bland or whatever? I've done that completely sort of melted away. I think the Grease cover is an absolute genius. Just all kinds of things flooded through my mind as I was listening to it. First of all, as you said, you know, the good name of Morrissey has been reestablished.
Yes.
the feel. I was thinking that the phrase kind of non-blackface white soul went through my head at one point. I mean,
yeah.
There was, because I think they're thinking of people like Afghan Whigs, Cowboy Junkies, you know, Lamb Chop and various kind of things. That sort of soulful feel about it. And the fact they cover things like, you know, Frank Ocean or whatever.
Yeah.
For instance, I just love that sort of, you know, that you know, it's got real, you know, it's got a sort of R&B sort of,
it's got a real warmth to it as well, a real,
you know,
euphoria.
Without aping R&B Mariners, yeah, for instance, you know, but you know, the same sort of saltiness, the same warmth, the same sentiment and the same attachment, but at the same time, you know, that sort of sense of distance as well, you know.
It's interesting what you said about coming to it cold, because so did I. I just like stuck it on without sort of, you know, just on Michael's recommendation, without realising it was a covers album, because the first few songs are all new songs by the new groups that I'm not paying attention to. Yeah. And then suddenly you start to hear a Leonard Cohen song.
Well, it was, you know, literally that. And I think the scheduling, the formatting and the ordering of this record is really interesting, because it, like both of you put it on, that's really, oh, a cover of Everyone Loves the Sunshine.
Yeah.
a pretty faithful cover of Everyone Loves the Sunshine. Oh, a cover of Grease. Oh, a cover of, you know, he's they've kept the well-known tunes that everyone knows.
Yeah.
Until the second half of the record.
Yeah.
Which, if you are listening to it cold,
yeah,
means you're halfway through
that
going
to me as well.
Enjoying it for its own for its own skill.
Ah, it's a covers album about 25 minutes in. The only one I thought was just slightly on the nose was Sunday Morning, oddly enough, because I think that gets covered quite a lot. But that's a hyper criticism, and it's not even barely a criticism.
I think at least with Sunday Morning, they've done something with arrangement. Lovely, they're not just turning it into here's another downbeat lament. I mean, Everybody Loves the Sunshine, I think, is the weakest thing on there because it's so faithful.
Yeah, it's almost a facsimile. Yeah, isn't it?
Even down to the little kind of.
I think the song selection is really terrific. But I think the real stars here. It's the Space Bomb setup. I mean, which everything that comes out of Space Bomb appears to be great. The Matthew E. White albums, the Natalie Press album from the start of last year, or the start of the year before. Time is starting to expand and contract in my middle age. Yeah. And
also sounds like an album on Space Bomb. Actually, time is starting to expand and contract in my middle age.
But the whole setup that gives it this kind of uniformity of sound, but without it ever sounding boring. I mean, I guess because they're not making it's a small group of guys in Richmond, Virginia, working in a house. So they're not making 15, 20 albums a year. They're making one or two albums a year, with the result that it all sounds fresh. They did this very quickly. It was recorded in 10 days, working from noon till midnight each night. And the verve, I think, of the performances is really terrific. I mean, something like this is easy to descend into tastefulness. And yes, it is tasteful. You can play this at dinner parties and no one's going to be upset. But the precision in the performances is fantastic to listen to. Everyone sounds like they are playing for the thrill of playing, which is a wonderful thing on records, I think. But the song selection is interesting too, because I mean, Matthew White had an unusual background. He was brought up in the Philippines, where his parents were Christian missionaries. Mm-hmm. We've all been there. I interviewed the pair of them just before Christmas, and I was saying, oh, so Grease, you know, that must have just been one of those ones that you've heard 14 times a year for your entire life. And Matthew White said, well, no, not at all, because, you know, we didn't watch Grease in the Philippines. It wasn't on telly all the time. So this is a song that I only know as a piece of craft songwriting. And he went at length about his admiration for the fact that Barry Gibb, rather than writing from the heart, as we're taught that songwriters are meant to do, could, hey, we need a theme tune for this movie. Can you knock something up? And comes up with something as perfect as the Grease theme.
Yeah. What about Flo Morrissey? I mean, because we've talked a lot here about the musicianship. Well, she is just fantastic here. The phrasing, the delicacy.
She comes from the folk scene, doesn't she?
Yeah.
It was, that sort of nice West London folk scene. I think her first album, her solo album was nice and pleasant. I went to see her live. I thought, this is nice and pleasant, but I'm not sure it's really for me. But on this, she delivers something completely unexpected.
I mean, to me, it is really good. But it feels overall like a piece of Americana. I mean, she's from Richmond or whatever, isn't it? But this feels like Americana, and it's done in Virginia. I mean, you can kind of feel that in a way. I think you can sometimes feel, you know, when great American records that come from the South, and you can feel the South in them, and you can feel what contributing factor that is.
Well, an interesting and to me very attractive epiphenomenon of this is that it sounds quite baggy. Sounds like Candy Flip. You know what I mean? It's
weird
all
the associations that kind of floated through my mind as I was listening to it. I was thinking of, like, at one point, I just remember for several minutes thinking, this is almost like recreating, like, Carter-era America, like, you know, 76, 77. I was thinking of, like, things like Afternoon Delight by Starlight. Just the sort of feeling, the choice of, like, textures or whatever, which is kind of interestingly sort of retro in places, but really good. And I mean, I think the arrangements, the flow of it is just absolutely lovely.
The most trite thing that people like ourselves can say about this kind of music is it's sun-kissed and sun-dappled, but it kind of is, isn't it? Yeah. And particularly in January, right now.
You can feel the heat rising.
On YouTube, there is a kind of short promo documentary about making the album, and it actually looks like a Netflix series. Like, hey, kids, let's get together and make an album. It just looks so, oh, God, I wish I was one of those
let's
people.
Let's do the show right here.
It does. Clearly, it actually was sun-kissed and sun-dappled.
Can I throw in a little, possibly a little grit of dissension? Is it really knowing? Is it a really kind of knowing record? Because I did feel at times that there was a little bit of a kind of a wry kind of hipsterish grin behind the whole thing.
Personally, I don't think so. Yeah. I think this is a born-again idealist record. I think this is post-cynicism. I think this is like, is this a beautiful song? Can we do it in a beautiful way? Do we really want to play it? Let's do it.
Yeah. And it wasn't a record where the songs were selected on the basis of, God, what's going to make us coolest? The
That was my worry when I heard the Grease thing. It was like, oh, right.
I found that completely respectful, and I think it should be respected. I think it is actually a very good song. It was a great inspired choice.
I mean, the most obscure choice on there, probably Looking For You, the Nino Ferrer cover. I mean, that wasn't one of those, oh, yes, I just want to prove that I've known Nino Ferrer for decades. Flo Morris, you said, oh, it came up on someone's Discover Weekly Spotify playlist, and they sent it to me. And I thought, oh, that's great, isn't it? Didn't know anything about him, but thought, what a great song.
Yeah,
so, it's
strange actually. I mean, from interviewing musicians for years, people got to make points about postmodern wry hipsterism, knowingness. Mm. I mean, musicians are a remarkably innocent bunch. Actually. Yeah, it was fine, and not always as sort of kind of informed and wry and as hip as you think. I mean, obviously, people cherry pick around more and more, which is a very sad thing because there's something about an album you listen to in total where, there's a sort of. Yeah, there's a kind of flow and a spirit about the thing that sort of generates a certain amount of goodwill, and then sometimes you're actually prepared to kind of if there's a slight weaker moment you kind of wave it. It's a bit like the old Ringo songs on the Beatles album, something like that. Even but I think if you listen to an album in sequence, there's something that is obviously a greater thing than the sum of its parts.
And, yes,
I'm glad that they put the Govinda chant at the end.
Yeah, frankly, absolutely.
I can't live
yeah.
without that one.
Although that is a 1990s baggy club.
That's totally that is Candy Flip in Ex Chelsea. Absolutely.
I think that's exactly
the speeding
point,
up as well.
Put that at the beginning, then.
Yeah.
Michael Hann, you've already had basically one choice by choosing the Flo Morrissey and Matthew E. White album. Let's have another one. Let's have another editor's recommendation. I believe you have something else for us.
I've picked Libondella by Afro 70, which was on a compilation of Kenyan and East African music that came out late last year. I'm by no means anyone's idea of a world music aficionado, but I'm kind of fascinated by the way that African music has become the nuggets and pebbles of this century and the rate that these compilations come out. And on almost all of them, there is something just absolutely delicious. And just like on Nuggets and Pebbles, on almost all of them, there's a fair amount that you'd never want to hear again unless you were deeply immersed in African music. But this track, I just think, was joyful. One of the most joyful things I've heard in I don't know how long. When I first got the album through, I was playing it at home. This track comes towards the end of the record. And I loved it so much. I think I played it about 12 times in a row with my family going, can't you put something else on? No, let's just hear this. And now I know that the music of New Orleans comes much more from the Caribbean and from West Africa than from East Africa. But it reminds me enormously of Iko Iko and things like that. I mean, it feels like it could be a New Orleans record, a New Orleans chanting call and response record. But if you talk about Sun Dapple, this isn't just Sun Dapple. This is Sun Blazing, this record.
Mm. Well, it's Non More Guardian. Get the quinoa on. It's Libondella by Afro 17. Roll over, George Monbiot. That was Libondella by Afro 70, chosen by Michael Hann of The Guardian. Okay, it's a bit 2016, but we could not let this week's Big Mouth go without mentioning the big losses of the Christmas period. 2016 really did not let up until the very last minute, and all three key figures were keenly felt by a certain generation, I think, of which most of our listeners are part. Rick Parfitt, of Status Quo, died on Christmas Eve from an infection after shoulder surgery, of all things. Carrie Fisher suffered a heart attack on a transatlantic flight the day before Christmas Eve and passed away 4 days later. And it was deeply saddening to hear their mother, Debbie Reynolds, herself died almost immediately afterwards. And of course, late on Christmas Day, we heard that George Michael had died in his sleep, age 53. David Stubbs, your old Melody Maker colleague, David Bennon, I think dug out a review where he'd written that George Michael spent his whole career trying so hard to be taken seriously without realising that he actually always was taken seriously, particularly in his early days. Is that the George Michael story, that it's this constant struggle for a recognition that actually he already had?
Yeah, well, I mean, personally, I don't quite go along with the sort of the mid-period, like Faith and things like that, and the duet with Aretha Franklin. I still find those things a little bit naff, myself, personally. But I love Wham. When it first came out, I thought Wham was fantastic. I'm a soul boy, doll boy.
Yeah.
The music, everything about them. And then it just went a little bit kind of naff for me. And then I pick up again on George Michael around this sort of time, actually. Yeah. I kind of warmed to him. much, much more in his kind of later years in every respect. The music he was making, it wasn't really, you know, anything like as popular as what he was doing before. The kind of person that he clearly was, you know, the kind of statements that he was making, and, you know, and the kind of poignancy of his decline to some degree. But yes, I mean, I think overall, yes, I mean, yes, I absolutely count myself very much, you know, as pro-George Michael, you know, despite, yeah. for me, you know, going kind of, you know, he goes off the radar for me in his most famous period, I suppose.
I think he's kind of, I mean, you're right, those early records, you hear them again now, you hear Club Tropicana or Wham Rap, and what you probably don't realise when you're 13 and they're out is how clever they are and how sophisticated. The arrangements are absolutely incredible. Young Guns is this brilliant mixture of a pop song and like a kind of, you know, Broadway musical with a little plot bit in the middle and the kind of call and response between the boys and the girls and the character arrangements. It's like Sharks and Jets or Seven Brides for Seven Brothers or something. Incredibly sophisticated. And he was about 19, wasn't he, when he put this thing together?
One of the ironies of of pop and pop culture is that just a couple of days before he died on Top of the Pops 82, they had Wham performing Young Guns.
It was right at the end, wasn't it?
Yeah, which I thought was their first Top of the Pops appearance, but I think probably wasn't. I think there may have been one before that can't get shown on BBC4 now for presenter-related reasons. But this in effect is, for people watching, it's the first time Wham appear on Top of the Pops, so de facto, really, at this point. And you watch it. I watched it, and this was obviously before Michael had died. And I was never a huge fan or anything. And when Wham were at their most popular, I was a teenage indie purist and all that stuff. But you watch the performance now, and it's just breathtaking. Yeah. You know, the verve of it, and the absolute commitment to it. Now, I read something after he died by one of the Top of the Pops producers saying, well, Wham had turned up, and they rehearsed that performance so much. You know, it's like they wanted to just absolutely be the stars of that show. No one else was going to be remembered off Top of the Pops that night apart from Wham.
Yeah.
And it was brilliant. And you look at George Michael, I think, God, this kid was so full of life and had so much to say. And in a way, I think some of the records he made in his later... People get old, of course they do. Yeah. Some of the records he made in his later years, I find a little dreary, if I'm honest. Mm. And I disagree with you about Faith. I think Faith itself, that single... I mean, the album, of course, was a monolith. But the single itself, I think, is just an astonishing kind of pop confection. And people forget that he wasn't just a singer. He was a songwriter and arranger and producer. He did everything.
He did a lot,
He was a Stevie Wonder-esque figure, except he didn't play every instrument. And Faith, listening to it again in the wake of his death, I think, actually, you know, he's taken what was happening around in pop in the couple of years before then, when we're seeing a lot of kind of modernised, techno-fied rock and roll, and taking that and doing it in a perfect way that no one else could possibly manage. Really sexual rockabilly number with the perfect pastiche James Burton guitar solo.
Well, amongst the many plaudits, obviously a lot came out about how quietly generous he'd been, and a lot came out about how he'd been a fantastic kind of unapologetic standard bearer for gay people. Sort of slightly hustled into it by events. He never particularly wanted to come out and make a big... But I thought he played it magnificently when it happened.
But I'd totally forgotten that there was lots of discussion about how he kind of donated anonymously to various charities and whatever. I love the thought of Wham turning up to a miners' benefit, I think, on the South Bank.
Festival Hall.
During the kind of non-more raincoat indie period of the miners' strike.
Yeah.
And coming on, and the only people in the audience who were at all pleased to see them there with a kind of 200 teeny bopper girls at the front screaming their heads off while everyone else stood around smoking roll-ups and drinking kind of Red Stripe out of cans, tutting that somebody who was so pop was muscling in on their kind of like...
Yeah, but who was right in the long run?
And who was preaching to the converted and who was actually making people think a little bit more about things that maybe they hadn't thought about?
Well, isn't it, I mean, you know, you were talking about Faith and as you were kind of, you know, you made a very good justification for it. And when I was, you know, I think at the time, part of the reason I would have disliked that was, you know, there were these kind of oppositions, things were a little bit more tribal or dialectical or whatever, and this now was not the time for white souls sort of thing. And I think now we're kind of sort of past all that collectively, and you can actually sort of admire things. If I would sit down and listen to Faith, I would say, I can see the craft of that. I can see, you know, I don't think I'll ever be able to love it because of associations or whatever, but I think you can at least sort of, when the smoke has cleared a bit, you can, you know, definitely admire
Can I also not let this pass without, you have mentioned him, but I was saddened more, actually, by Rick Parfitt's
death. I was just about to come to you on this very subject.
It's not that I was a huge Quo fan. I like Quo. I have seen Quo a couple of times. But I just knew the moment he died that there were going to be a load of people going, oh, status quo, oh, I only wrote one song. Oh. And I ended up writing on Christmas Eve a kind of tribute to Rick Parfitt that got a little prickly and defensive about this. Because, you know, when George Michael died the next day, you knew that everyone was going to be going, George Michael, what a tragedy. But, you know, Rick Parfitt was, he's kind of one of the founding blocks of British pop music.
Yeah.
A constant in the charts for decades. I think the Quo have had more top 20 hits than any other group, is that right? Mm-hmm. I haven't checked the stats before coming on. But also, you know, they deserve a certain amount of credit for being completely against the flow in the mid-70s. I mean, Quo at their best, this is absolutely brutal, monolithic rock music that's focused on one thing. The comparison to the Ramones has been made quite a lot in the last couple of weeks, but I think there's some justification to it. Although I prefer, I took Bob Stanley to see Quo when the Frantic Four reformed 2 or 3 years ago, and Bob went up more out of curiosity, but being Bob Stanley out of Saint-Étienne and pop historian, he had his theories all developed about how Caroline is clearly a cousin to Steve Reich and systems music in its intro.
Actually, you know what? That's kind of plausible, yeah.
But also with a fantastic line about how about their use of repetition and drone. He said, they're the Norwood Noi.
Well, it's certainly the case that Status Quo were always criticised for exactly the same thing that AC/DC and the Ramones are praised for.
The AC/DC were criticised for it for a very long time, Andrew. It's only the last 5-10 years that people have come around.
20 years. Anyway, Carrie Fisher, we should just speak briefly about her as well. I mean, you were upset about Rick Parfitt. That destroyed you. It was Carrie Fisher that destroyed me. You know, this was the biggest part of my youth and the biggest part of, you know, somebody who's so associated with beauty, vitality, outspokenness, being your own person. To die so young is just absolutely heartbreaking.
Well, Michael was talking about the kind of the weird things that pop music throws up and Wham on Top of the Pops just before George Michael died. The fact that a film that was released a week before Carrie Fisher died, which had a animated version of the young Carrie Fisher in, is kind of slightly...
It is in its own way. It's a little bit like this time last year when Black Star comes out on the Friday and we have 2 days while Bowie's alive and then he's dead on the Monday. That, to me, that's like, we had a very brief period when the young Carrie Fisher was among us. I mean, yeah, we could go on for a great period of time about how she was so much more than Princess Leia. She was a fantastic script doctor, you know, often uncredited.
Well, Postcards from the Edge was one of the... I mean, I think it was one of the first kind of like pulling the lid off Hollywood... books that I ever read, and it was just like, wow,
incredible.
They let somebody write this.
Yeah, memoirist, if there's such a thing as a memoirist. And it's just so sad to think that somebody who could have had a good, you know, coda to a brilliant career is now not going to get it. So she is one with the force. Let's play her out with this. This is, well, I couldn't think of anything more appropriate. This is the Imperial Battle March in dub by Matto. The French dub band Matto with the Imperial Battle March from Empire Strikes Back, in dub, of course. So now we're at the end of the show and it is time for closing time chatter, where our guests offload whatever is getting their goat this week. David Stubbs, what's occupying your mind at the moment?
Like quite a few people, my Facebook, whatever, I discovered that site, Radio Garden. I haven't even seen where you can, you know, it's this sort of application whereby you can kind of, you know, sort of drag a pointer across this kind of virtual globe, and then a light on these little sort of green, these little green flashing lights that, and you know, Iran or Peru or whatever, and you know, and a local radio station will strike up, and yeah, and it's absolutely fantastic. Except I must admit, I did have this kind of like pang of disappointment in some ways about this. I mean, at one point, you know, I was hovering over Pakistan.
Yeah,
and I thought, wow, you know, and yeah, and I heard one of the most magnificent, haunting pieces of music of my life. It's Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys. Yeah, every part of the world, you know, I heard Status Quo in Guam, you know, I heard Tears for Fears in New Zealand, whatever, or in the Philippines. And it's just like, there was this sort of slight sense of the world having shrunk a great deal. Like everybody, you know, that there's been a sort of globalization of, you know, of Western pop. And also I think that sort of local indigenous musics, you know, have tended to become slightly sort of, this is kind of sort of electro sheen that sort of crosses everywhere. Everything's slightly kind of Eurovisionish or whatever. And, you know, there's a certain sort of glaze.
Standardization.
Yeah, yes. That's right. A standardization that's taking place. I was just thinking, like, well, when Holger Shukai did his shortwave radio thing, I'm sure that, you know, you could sort of turn the dial a bit and he would find all of this kind of musical otherness, as it were. That I think it's there, but it's much, much harder to find now. I think it's a great tool, and I think if you do sort of spend long enough, you know, you will find some really, really good things, but you're not just going to find it immediately. 30 years ago, I went on holiday to Turkey and had like one of the old sort of beatbox type things with the radio and a cassette thing, and I was able to sort of tape Turkish radio and like the music coming off it. And it was all fantastic, and you didn't have to sit there for ages waiting for something good to happen. It was just all great.
Yeah.
But, you know, you do get the impression there's this sort of global standardisation. Yeah, maybe that's not such a bad thing in certain respects, and maybe this search for the authentic other is a bit spurious in itself. But
Michael Hann,
I have just read The Descent of Man by Grayson Perry, which, as Dorothy Parker said, is not a book to be set aside lightly. It is one to be tossed away with great force. A book that was only published because its author is famous, what we might call Morrissey syndrome. Grayson Perry is writing about masculinity. His entire thesis can be boiled down to being macho is a bad thing. Yeah, we're not going to argue with that. I would invert Voltaire, and I may agree with what you say, but I would fight to the death for your right not to have it published. it's at best a 2,000-word essay of extremely familiar stuff wrapped up in a 140-page book full of unsupported arguments, assertions that he assumes we're going to take on faith. Not a single statistic is sourced, and this is disloyal of me to my employer.
Yes.
But it sometimes appears as if his only source for anything he says is an article in The Guardian said, mate, you've got to read more widely.
Wasn't an article written by his wife in The Guardian, was it?
It wasn't, thankfully. His wife does crop up in it. No reason she shouldn't. But his memoir was a really good book. That's the shame about this. I approached this book thinking, this should at least be interesting. But you can kind of imagine the commissioning that went on, the commissioning process. So he springs off from his TV series about masculinity. But a TV series is one thing. So you've got an editor with you, you've got a producer with you, you've got researchers with you. This, it's just him in front of a typewriter. And you can bet the publishers went, yeah, Grayson Perry on masculinity. He wears a dress. Mm. What could be better? Because as editors, we've all done those kind of commissions.
Yeah. So who got you this for Christmas? Would you rather have the Beano annual?
It wasn't bought for me for Christmas. We were actually reading it for our book group.
Reading for your
North
book
London group. Men read a book about the crisis of masculinity. What a bunch of sounds.
I think you should write a book about a North London book group of men reading books about the crisis of masculinity, because that's the book group on Channel 4. That fantastic show years ago, the book group.
Yeah, no, it's great. Yeah,
they all read books, and they all hated each other.
Go on. Go on, pick Sven Hassel next.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Wheels of Terror.
Oh, man, Wheels of Terror and Legion. Well, I'd go with SS General or perhaps Simon Gestapo.
Yeah,
poor Sven Hassel. Yeah. Just slipped completely off the radar. A few years ago, I tried to put together a piece about Sven Hassel and his disappearance, his utter disappearance from being everywhere in all bookshops, especially W.H. Smith's, to being nowhere. It never quite came through, but there were some quite interesting things. Big controversy about Sven Hassel, about whether he
complete
really was
fantasist.
What he claimed.
Yeah. I actually prefer the idea that he's a fantasist rather than being actually doing it all. Like,
was in a penal battalion. He wasn't a willing soldier in the Nazi forces, apart from people said, no, he was. Yeah. He joined up.
Is he
dead?
He
was a Dane who joined up. Yes.
Is he dead? Yeah. Okay, so we can say what we like about him. Okay. He was a Nazi. Matt Hall, have you got for
Hold the front page. I was just really taken this week by welcoming a new organ to our body, the 79.
You personally?
No, everyone. The mesentery was discovered. A new organ in the stomach, or rather connecting the intestine to the stomach. They don't know what it does, but they know that it's there. And it was discovered rather by the brilliantly named Professor J. Calvin Coffey from the University of Limerick.
Amazing.
It's totally amazing.
And we don't know what it does.
It's coming to a cinema near you soon as Appendix 2.
there's some talk of it anchoring the gut to the backbone, which prevents everything inside sloshing around.
Amazing.
Brilliantly, they're having to rewrite Grey's Anatomy, not the TV series, but the actual book. And it was incorrectly identified back in the 1880s. And ever since then, as not an organ, and ever since then, all the guidebooks to the gut have gone, it's not an organ, it's just a kind of bit of random muscle. And they're now saying, no, it is. And even more brilliantly, Leonardo da Vinci kind of sketched it, so he knew back then that it was there was something.
And what's it called again?
It's called the Mesentery.
So how long before there's a band in Dalston called Mesentery?
I think they're already cutting a demo down at that studio
that
with the guy. Yeah, Toe Rag Studios.
Liam Watson, yeah, fantastic. Okay, well, my closing time chatter is just a very quick one. I just want to give a big up to Rebecca Ferguson for, if she has been offered an opportunity to perform at the Donald Trump inauguration, for saying she'll only do it if she can perform Strange Fruit. I hope it's true. I almost hope she does it, because that's pretty much the only thing pop music's got to offer right now. Sing the songs and articulate what they've got to say. It's probably not true, is it? It's probably just something that's sort of fuzzed up into the chatosphere, but it made me feel better about her. And I also think that she should follow up on, there is a clamour out there that what Rebecca Ferguson really needs to do is record an album of diva house bangers. She has the voice to do Baby Let Me Love You for Tonight, or, you know, Wait by Kim Mazelle and Dr. Roberts. This is, destiny is calling her to do this. So I think, you know, big mouth people get emailing and insist that she performs her duty. So that's our show. Thank you for listening. Thank you to our guests. Thank you to David Stubbs, whose Future Day is Krautrock and the Building of Modern Germany is available now in all good bookshops. Thank you, David, for coming in. Thank you to Guardian music editor Michael Han, whose The Guardian is also available now in all good newsagents. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
And for free on the web.
And for free. Don't say that.
Yeah, buy it, though. Better if you buy it.
Or click on the bit at the bottom where they say give us 40 quid or something like that. Remember, you can hear this show again and all of our past shows at audioboom.com. And if you do audioboom.com/channel/bigmouth, you'll see the lot there and you can click and play to your heart's content and also download. Or why not subscribe at iTunes? Just go to the podcast section, search for Big Mouth, subscribe, and you will never miss out on your weekly dose of pop culture chat ever again. In fact, loyal subscribers get the podcast version a day early. Matt and I will be back on SohoRadioLondon.com at 9 a.m. next Sunday with a full show, including full-length songs. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Have a lovely week. And yeah, 2017 is going to be amazing.